Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
And movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
We would be honoured if you would join us.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always, that's everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, it's given away in the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about production stories, marketing stories, release stories, distribution stories, all the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try really hard not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow, films manage to get made. Each episode of the podcast, or each standard episode of the podcast, I look at two different films. And, you know, that's enough preamble, isn't it? Let's get on with the first. I'm going to take you back to 1998 for the first of the two movies I'm talking about. As always, I'm going to set it up with a clip from the film. This one's a bit of a loud one, though.
Let's go! Expectant, morphine. Routine. Priority. He's gone.
That then, of course, was a clip from 1998 Saving Private Ryan, written by Robert Rodack, directed by Steven Spielberg. The cast led by Tom Hanks and also featuring Edward Burns, Matt Damon, Tom Sizemore, Vin Diesel in there as well. Now, across his career, as he would tell Richard Schickel in the book Spielberg, Steven Spielberg inevitably received lots of screenplays via his representation. Now, most of the time, the films that he ended up making, to a degree, he developed himself, that it wasn't a screenplay that came through on spec that perked his interest, really. But in the case of Saving Private Ryan, it was just that. It was the first time in his career he said that a script arrived in his inbox and he wanted to make it. Now, As it headed into the 1990s, Spielberg had been looking for a World War II combat script. There's a lovely story around the making of Aardman's Chicken Run, which was made for Spielberg's company, DreamWorks SKG, where Nick Park, the co-director of Chicken Run and the creator of Wallace and Gromit, of course, sat down with Spielberg and pitched Chicken Run as The Great Escape with chickens. And Spielberg said to Nick Park that The Great Escape is one of his favourite films of all time, and he keeps chickens. Well, The Great Escape was a touch point for Spielberg in his love of World War II movies. But he was receiving lots of scripts around World War II material, but it was when he received Robert Rodat's script for Saving Private Ryan that he quickly declared, this is the one. It came together really, really quickly at that point as well, because Tom Hanks had also had the script at the same time. And as Spielberg told Richard Schickor, as it happened, the script had been sent to Hanks. I read the script, he read the script, and we on the telephone said, let's do this together. It happened in one day. So let's rewind a little bit back to Robert Rodat, because by the mid-1990s, he was a writer having some success, relatively unknown in the circle of Hollywood. He was in his later 30s, but he'd worked on the family film Fly Away Home, really delightful film that. He'd also worked on a Western starring Scott Glenn by the name of Tall Tale. He'd come to the attention of a producer by the name of Mark Gordon, who arranged a meeting with him. And as the New York Times put it, actually, the film, as in Saving Private Ryan, was written by Robert Rodat, a relatively unknown 39-year-old screenwriter who said the idea came to him 4 years ago in a village near Keene, where he has a home. And it was during the 50th anniversary celebrations of D-Day, while looking at a monument to the soldiers killed in wars since the American Revolution, that he noticed some of the soldiers were brothers. As Robert Rodat told the New York Times, the idea of losing a son to war is painful beyond description. The idea of losing more than one son is inconceivable. And it was that catalyst, that the trip to that village and the discovery of the monument, that unlocked what would become Saving Private Ryan, based on a partly true story, but not an entirely true story. So let's go back to producer Mark Gordon of Mutual Film Company, and he arranged a meeting with Robert Rodat, and they developed Saving Private Ryan for around 18 months. It was Mark Gordon who sent the draft in to Paramount Pictures. Paramount Pictures liked it, bought the draft up, and continued to do some development work on the screenplay. And at one stage, actually, Michael Bay was set to direct the film. That by the early to mid-1990s, Michael Bay was in a very in-demand director. That his directorial debut Bad Boys had turned into a hit, 1996's The Rock had turned into a real hit as well. And Bay would reflect on some of the films he turned down in a piece over at Collider. I mean, he turned down films like Black Hawk Down, that went on to be made by Ridley Scott. But he said, I was given Saving Private Ryan before Steven Spielberg. Michael Bay, in fairness as well, he would add that when he saw the eventual film, he knew he couldn't do that. He said when he saw it, he thought it was the greatest first scene of any movie he'd ever seen. And he just said, I would never have done a better job. Around the same time as well, Spielberg's company actually offered Michael Bay Small Soldiers to direct, which ultimately went to Joe Dante. It was said that the reason Michael Bay struggled to get a handle, really, with Saving Private Ryan is he just couldn't get on top of the material. He picked a different project instead that would come out the same summer. That would be Armageddon. I love Armageddon. I know that's a fairly divisive opinion. To my mind, that is the last really good Michael Bay film. I hope he makes another really good film at some point. The script then to Saving Private Ryan was at Paramount Pictures. Paramount got it sent to Tom Hanks. It also got to Spielberg as well. Now, there is a conflicting story to Spielberg's account in the Schickor book. And according to the New York Times, it was Hanks that got Spielberg the script. But either way, they both saw it on pretty much the same day and they both wanted to do it. Now, they were on board. Paramount wasn't going to say no to that pair. There was still work to do that Spielberg launched into extensive research on World War II, and a rewrite followed. I mean, what Spielberg knew talking to veterans of the war was he couldn't do a glossy, sanitised World War II movie. He felt that would not be representative of the war. And also veterans were telling him, just don't make that film. We've seen too many of those films. And so some uncredited rewrite work was done. Scott Frank came in and did some work on it. Frank Darabont came in and did some work on it as well. And Saving Private Ryan was moving forward. But this also came at an odd time for Steven Spielberg, because in 1993, he'd had two of the biggest successes of his career. Commercially, it was Jurassic Park. Critically, it was Schindler's List that would win 7 Academy Awards. There was pressure then after that. How on earth do you follow those films up? What do you direct next? Well, it would be many years before he did. And his attention was taken to a project that he was working on with David Geffen and Jeffrey Katzenberg. Jeffrey Katzenberg, who had left Disney at this point after overseeing animated successes such as The Lion King and Aladdin. The trio co-founded DreamWorks SKG, the first big new studio in Hollywood for some time, capturing some of the spirit of United Artists of Hollywood past as well. And the expectation was that with Spielberg now at DreamWorks, he would direct movies for his own company. But when he did decide to direct a film again, the first film he would make would actually be for another studio altogether. Eyebrows would be raised around town for this, but he would make for Universal The Lost World Jurassic Park 2. Or The Lost World Jurassic Park. It didn't have a 2 in the title, did it? But also, what he was planning around that point was to do what he'd done with Jurassic Park and Schindler's List, to go from one film to the next. Now, in this case, that was going to be The Lost World to Amistad. And Amistad, starring Matthew McConaughey and Anthony Hopkins and Jermaine Hounsou, terrific work in that film, would be the first film he would direct for DreamWorks. But as things came together, it turned out he was going to do 3 films back to back, an incredibly taxing endeavour, because Spielberg wanted to do Saving Private Ryan. He wanted DreamWorks in to co-produce it. Paramount wanted to be a part of it as well. I should point out, fairly early in the process, Mark Gordon and his team stepped aside. There's no way they were going to produce the film. They would get a credit, they would get a slice of cash for their work, but their creative input would stop at the point Spielberg and his team jumped aboard. It was then a case, though, with these two studios of just who's going to distribute the movie, because they came up with a co-financing plan for it. And it came down to a toss of a coin. Who's going to release Saving Private Ryan in America? Who's going to release it in the rest of the world? Now, Spielberg won the coin toss. And the coin toss was with Sumner Redstone, who was overseeing the company that oversaw Paramount Pictures. And with the coin toss won, DreamWorks took what were perceived to be the more lucrative rights, which were for the US, the US territories. Paramount would release the film elsewhere in the world. Also, though, the film Deep Impact was in the midst of this deal as well, because as part and parcel of this, and as part and parcel of that coin toss as well, Paramount would now release Deep Impact in the US and would come in to co-finance that. DreamWorks would release it elsewhere in the world. Saving Private Ryan wasn't going to be a massively expensive film to make, though. The negative cost was going to be in the region of $65 to $70 million, around the same price as Jurassic Park 4 years earlier. But 4 or 5 years earlier, actually. But this was based on both Spielberg and Hanks cutting their upfront fees to, well, not to zero, but not far off, but instead taking on a very, very lucrative back end. That there are a couple of reports around Hollywood Press at the time that suggested they both took 17.5% of the first dollar gross, not of the profit, of basically every dollar spent at the box office. Between the pair of them, they took 35% of the money. These deals were relatively commonplace at this point. And I mean, notably, a long way back in the history of this podcast, I cover Lethal Weapon 4, Mel Gibson, Danny Glover, director Richard Donner. And as much as that film looked like it made a profit on the surface, the fact that all of the key creatives on it had a first dollar gross deal meant that Warner Brothers barely scraped even on that particular sequel. Hanks was going to lead the cast, that much was known. Spielberg was going to direct. Casting-wise, the rest of the ensemble came together. Tom Sizemore had to pledge to stay clean throughout the duration of the shoot, else he would be off the film. Edward Burns was directing film. I mean, he'd broken through directing The Brothers McMullen and She's the One, a pair of really good films. I mean, they're not talked about an awful lot, but he was a really big deal when The Brothers McMullen came through. And it was a bit of an interesting coup, really, that he would take on an acting role in this film. Another person who took on their first major Hollywood acting role in Saving Private Ryan was Vin Diesel, and he also landed the work based off films he directed himself, because he was reportedly working in telemarketing at the point the call came in. But Spielberg had seen one of the short films that Diesel had directed and duly cast him as part of the Saving Private Ryan ensemble. Also not known at this point was a young actor called Matt Damon, who'd broken through a film called School Ties, which also all sorts of talent breakthrough. I mean, Brendan Fraser is one of the ensemble there. But he was making a film called Good Will Hunting at this point. And so Spielberg met with Robin Williams on the set of Good Will Hunting, who introduced him to Matt Damon. Francis Ford Coppola was casting him in the adaptation of John Grisham's The Rainmaker around the same time as well. But Matt Damon took on a supporting role in Saving Private Ryan. Again, a real breakthrough role for where his career was at that point. Edward Norton was said to have been offered a part, a previous guest on this podcast as well. He declined in favour of making the film American History X, which I'm coming to on a future episode of Film Stories. But the core cast was pretty much together here, and that core cast was then sent off to do a week-long, proper, full-on army boot camp ahead of filming. A boot camp that was so intense that some of the actors wanted to basically just step away and just quit. But Tom Hanks talked some of his colleagues, as the story goes, out of quitting. He was the leader of that particular troop, and so they completed, I think, 6-7 days of full-on army training. For Spielberg, he wasn't doing army training. He was finishing off Amistad while Saving Private Ryan was in pre-production. Now, his director of photography on Saving Private Ryan was Janusz Kamiński. And between the pair of them, they did consider for a while following the path of Schindler's List and shooting the movie in black and white. But they decided against it. And instead, what they wanted to look at, and what they were looking at, was more archive war films of like the 1940s, 1950s, and the muted colour palette you got with those. And so what Janusz Kamiński did in the end was he actually physically adjusted the cameras and the lenses to change really the kind of footage that was being captured and the colour mix of the footage that was being captured. This allowed no safety net as well, because it was being changed at a hardware level. I mean, there was only so much you could do if you didn't like everything once it was developed. So it was a bit of a gamble there. It was also a little bit of a gamble where to shoot the film, because they decided not to shoot in France. Now, a couple of weeks ago on this podcast, I covered Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk movie, and his filming of the Dunkirk landings was shot on the beaches of Dunkirk in France. He went to an awful lot of effort to get the requisite permissions they required, and a lot of hoops had to be jumped through. And in the end, with Saving Private Ryan, they didn't do that, and instead they looked at beaches in and around the UK, but there were difficulties there as well, and the environment for attracting overseas filmmakers and the tax breaks just weren't as good in the UK at this point. And so Spielberg decided to shoot Saving Private Ryan, certainly for the key Omaha Beach scene that I'm coming to shortly, on the coast of Ireland instead. As The Lost World was into cinemas and giving Spielberg another hit, he started shooting Saving Private Ryan on June the 27th of 1997. He would shoot the movie quickly, and he would get through a lot of setups and a lot of footage in a day. And just to give you a flavour how fast he'd moved, between the end of filming on Jurassic Park 2 and the start of filming on Amistad, he had 4 weeks. From the end of Amistad to the start of Saving Private Ryan, he had 6 weeks. If you put that in the context of under Directors Guild of America rules, directors are generally given 10 weeks to fashion a first cut. You can see how quickly he was moving. It wasn't just he was in post-production on one film. He had to do the prep on the one he was moving to next. And in the case of Saving Private Ryan, there was a lot of prep. This was heavy location work that was going to be required. And as Spielberg would admit, he was doing a lot of this on instinct by the time he got to the beach in Ireland. Emotionally said he really enjoyed making this, but he was feeling really the pace of having made two films before back to back, and now here he was into his third. But he was motivated to tell this story, particularly for his dad and his dad's generation. His dad had fought in World War II, and he wanted to make this film with them in mind. Now, the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan inevitably dominates conversation about the film's production. In fact, it snared over $10 million of the budget of the movie alone. But Spielberg explained to Richard Schickel that I did the whole thing as a stream of consciousness. He said I had no storyboards. He didn't do pre-visualization. He said I did the whole thing from up here. Square brackets, tapping his head. He said he was informed by all the literature he'd read about what it was like to survive that day on Dog Green, Omaha Beach. What he didn't know when he started shooting that beach sequence was how long he was going to need to shoot it, because he hadn't storyboarded it. It's worth reiterating this. It would take 24 days in the end to get all of the footage for that sequence. And during that production, his team would come up to him and say, what are we going to be shooting next week? And Spielberg, in all honesty, he just didn't know, because at that point that they were asking the question, he was only so far across the beach, and he had to work out with a lot of instinctual directing how they were going to get to the next stage. How are you going to keep building this sequence? Now, one person who was amongst the supporting artists on the beach that day is an actor by the name of Andrew Scott. Look how his career has taken off. And it's about 10 years ago, I spoke to him about, I think he was in Sherlock at the time, and I just asked him what it was like being an extra on the beach as Spielberg was shooting that sequence. And I mean, the memory was burned in his retinas. He said, we shot it in Coraclo Beach in South Ireland. He said, there were a group of us that were working in the theatre in Ireland. We went down. He said, I'll never forget the day. I remember it being a really, really sunny day, and we went to the beach. I turned to one of the guys and I said, suddenly it's gone really, really cloudy. And one of the guys turned to him and said, Andrew, they covered up the sun. And it was because there was so much smoke. There was smoke all over for the extras to run through. And he said the sequence, and it's quite a simple sequence really, was a bunch of actors go from a boat on D-Day and try to get to the other side of the beach. Now, the coordination of shooting that sequence is just absolutely mind-boggling. But as Andrew Scott said at the time, everybody was given a very specific route to take amongst all the stunt performers. And the stunt performers had squibs, some of them had fake limbs. And as Scott said, it was so well choreographed. He said it took 2 weeks to do, and afterwards it was just extraordinary to watch. But when the cameras rolled, I mean, the challenge there was you couldn't see the camera, you couldn't see Spielberg, you had no idea of the camera work, you had no idea where they were. It was just you heard action, you had the sound of explosions, you had dirt flying in your face, you couldn't really see anything. You kind of knew that when it was editing together, it was going to be extraordinary though. And he described it as an amazing experience. It was an amazing experience for a lot of people, because there were over 1,000 people involved just in front of the camera alone for the Omaha Beach sequence. Each of them needed costumes, of course. Each of them needed special boots. And just the sheer scale of the effort to realise just one key opening sequence in the film, albeit one that went on for, 20, 25 minutes, was really, really intense. Once Spielberg had got what he needed in the can there, filming would then move to England over the summer of 1997, and then it would finish up in France in September. And Spielberg, as he got into the habit of doing, he finished filming ahead of schedule. Then he had to go straight into finishing off the film Amistad ahead of release for that Christmas. Meanwhile, Kaminski was developing the film using a process that then desaturated the image too. So all sorts of gambles really with the look of the movie. The promotion and the marketing was going to be tricky, because what DreamWorks and Paramount decided to do was release this in a high summer July release slot. It is worth noting that in the summer of 1998, Hollywood studios and production companies were sending over 100 movies into cinemas, an extraordinary number. The summer of 1998 was said to be one of the most competitive that Hollywood had known for some time as well. And if you, I mean, just look at the movies that were coming out that were around that summer. I mean, you had The Mask of Zorro, you had Lethal Weapon 4, you had Armageddon, you had Small Soldiers, you had Milan, you had, I mean, Titanic, you had Deep Impact, you had The Truman Show, you had 6 Days, Seven Nights, you had The X-Files. They just kept coming and coming and coming and coming. And in the midst of it, you had a film that came in at 170 minutes, a really intense World War II movie that, in truth, nobody really knew how it was going to go down. That the trailer, in fact, the first trailer for the film has no dialogue in it. at all. And I mean, DreamWorks was being very, very savvy in the way that it promoted and the way that it pushed the movie out. But still, this was going to be a really tough sell. It came back with an R rating from the Motion Picture Association of America as well. And I mean, there'd been a fear for a while that it was going to get the dreaded NC-17, which meant lots of cinemas wouldn't show it. But the sheer level of the visceral nature of the violence in the film, which is reflective, of course, of what the veterans had gone through. But Spielberg feared that that would put him on the wrong side of the ratings board. The summer season kicked off with some of the pressure being alleviated where DreamWorks was concerned as well, because by 1998, it needed a hit. Its first release in cinemas had been the George Clooney, Nicole Kidman headlined film The Peacemaker, directed by Mimi Leder. It was Mimi Leder's second film, the studio, Deep Impact, which, of course, DreamWorks had traded off half of the rights for, that started the summer season off with an incredible result for the studio. It was a big hit movie to kick things off. But in the build up to the release of Saving Private Ryan, DreamWorks realized it couldn't approach this in quite the same way. It couldn't do a big glitzy premiere. I mean, do you remember when the Pearl Harbor movie came out and they had a $4 million premiere that took place on an aircraft carrier or something like that? None of that. This was needed to be far more appropriate, and just the way that it was promoted needed to be tonally correct. The movie would premiere, I mean, it would debut on July the 24th, 1998 in US cinemas. And the critical response to it was pretty much incredible, in particular for the opening of the film. The opening sequence was just blowing people away. The brutality of it, the authenticity of it, the horror of it, just how visceral it was. And while people had problems with the film as it got towards its latter stages, the general critical consensus for the movie was incredibly, incredibly strong. Personally, I think it's not just the opening sequence. There are moments towards the end of the film as the ensemble are hearing the rumble of approaching tanks, and the sound work in Saving Private Ryan in those sequences is really, really something, I would suggest. But it's all too well the critics going for it. Would audiences lap it up in the middle of summer? Well, let's take a look. It opened in number one slot at the US box office with a really strong $30.5 million opening weekend. This is for an R-rated film, nearly 3 hours long, with a World War II theme. And, you know, I appreciate I'm recording this a year after Oppenheimer, or nearly a year after Oppenheimer, has grossed nearly $1 billion and taken home loads of Oscars. But Saving Private Ryan was a real outlier in this summer. I mean, it too was no sure thing. It knocked The Mask of Zorro off the top of the chart. Lethal Weapon 4 was in third place. A real surprise hit, actually. There's Something About Mary was in fourth. Michael Bay's Armageddon in fifth. Dr. Dolittle starring Eddie Murphy. I mean, that was a really big hit. Easy to overlook that. There was Disturbing Behavior in seventh. Jim Abrams' spoof movie, a forgotten one, this Mafia starring Lloyd Bridges, that was in eighth. There's Small Soldiers in ninth, also not directed by Michael Bay. Disney's Mulan in 10th. But all of these films were grossing, on the whole, with one or two exceptions, reasonable amounts of money. So with the arrival of, I mean, the Negotiator the week after, with Kevin Spacey and Samuel L. Jackson, and Disney's remake of The Parent Trap, could Saving Private Ryan hold the number one slot? Well, yes. And it didn't just hold it. Its audience shrunk by just 22.8% on its second weekend. This is a real result. I mean, now we look at audience drops of, what, 50-60% on a second weekend just as standard. But 23 million in its second weekend. The Parent Trap, really like the remake of The Parent Trap, 11.1 million. Negotiator opened with 10. Drew Barrymore in Ever After, A Cinderella Story, was in fifth place with 8.5 million. The hugely underrated Basketball was a box office disappointment in 11th place with $3 million. Saving Private Ryan held its place the weekend after as well, holding off Brian De Palma's Snake Eyes, starring Nicolas Cage, with that really long that really long Steadicam opening shot as well, although there's hidden edits in it. Halloween H20, 20 years later, or Halloween H20. How do you say that? Don't know, never thought about it. That was in third place and a box office success. Saving Private Ryan had another top spot the week after as films such as How Stella Got Her Groove Back and The Avengers failed to dethrone it. And in the end, the film that knocked it off the top after 5 weeks on release was Blade, starring Wesley Snipes. Saving Private Ryan at the US box office alone grossed $216 million. Overseas, $265 million. The coin toss didn't really pay off, although that DreamWorks would take more of a slice of a US release than it would international. So maybe it did in terms of profit. But the worldwide gross of Saving Private Ryan was $481 million. An incredible result considering the subject matter and the film. But then it found itself in the midst of one of the most controversial awards races of the last 20, 30 years, because Saving Private Ryan was expected to win the Best Picture Academy Award. In fact, Spielberg picked up his second Best Director Oscar for Saving Private Ryan and went to the stage and admitted that he really wanted to win it, which you're looking at it thinking, Steven Spielberg, you don't need an Oscar. Also, you've already got one. But it mattered a lot to him. But that when Harrison Ford took to the stage and read out the winner of the Best Picture, it went to Shakespeare in Love. Now, this was the year that Harvey Weinstein, the convicted rapist, his really over-the-top campaigning for the Best Picture prize was seen to have been A, successful, and B, a turning point, really, that Weinstein's tactics in terms of how he lobbied for Academy Awards really came to the fore. And in fact, Edward Zwick's just released his memoir, and he has some really interesting stuff to say about how he was frozen out on the stage of the Academy Awards when Shakespeare in Love won Best Picture. That notwithstanding, I will come to Shakespeare in Love in a future episode of the podcast. But for the purposes of Saving Private Ryan, nearly $500 million in the bank and also Academy Awards on its shelf as well. This was a real, real success. And I mean, crucially as well, the opening sequence has had a real impact, I think, just not just on cinema, I'd also suggest on video games as well, because there's a video game, Medal of Honor Allied Assault, that came out many, many years later that basically recreates that opening sequence on the beach. And out of that game eventually came the Call of Duty video game franchise. And so while it wasn't Spielberg's intent that that's what it would lead to, that was a byproduct of some of the most visceral filmmaking in Steven Spielberg's career. He would follow up the three films that he made, of which Saving Private Ryan will prove to be the most acclaimed, a couple of years later with the film AI, Artificial Intelligence. But predictably, I'm going to come to that in a future episode of the podcast. And that brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. I'm going to do my parish notices now, if you can just indulge me slightly. If you like this podcast and don't mind supporting it, there are a few ways you can do so. I mean, you're already supporting it by listening to it, and I hugely appreciate that. If you go to Patreon, patreon.com/SimonBrew, and put some coins in the pot there, you get the podcast early and you get it ad-free pretty much every week. You find out the gossip of what we're up to behind the scenes as well. I've also given away a free digital copy back issue of Film Stories on the Patreon feed as well. Thank you to everybody who's been supporting me on there. I've had some tremendous support. It's much appreciated. Costing you nothing is to subscribe to this podcast at your podcast host of choice. Thank you again to everyone doing that, and likewise to everyone leaving a hugely positive review. Stuff like that really helps with the algorithms with independent podcasts like this. I also do print magazines, and I'm delighted that issue 49 of Film Stories magazine is on sale now. It's nearly selling out as well. I'm absolutely thrilled. It is 168 pages, and we've led with, I think there's 14, 15 British independent movies on the front cover. Every movie on our front cover this issue is an indie film, and also it's backed up with articles on every single one of them inside the magazine. We have had an amazing response to it. If you would like your copy of that or of Film Junior magazine as well, just go to store.filmstories.co.uk. But that's enough parish notices for the minute. I'm going to now move on to the second of the two films I'm going to talk about in this episode of Film Stories. This is a brilliant movie I'm about to talk about, one that barely anyone has seen, that should have won lots of awards. I'm going to kick things off with a clip from the trailer. I'll come to the story of this on the other side of this clip.
Can you come help me set up?
What do we need to set up?
The room for the meeting. But the room's okay?
I think so.
The placement of the table is good.
Do you have the tissue box?
Of course.
Oh, no, don't put it in the center. It looks freaky.
Right. I'm sorry. Of course.
What are these?
That was a school project. It's supposed to be stained glass. Is there something wrong?
I don't know if I can do it.
Is the room okay for you?
Table, chairs, Jesus watching us. It's great.
Richard, Linda, this is Jay and Gail Perry.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks.
I'm grateful to see you all together finally. And I'm hopeful that we all think that this was a good thing to do by the time we leave here today.
We want to listen and we want to heal.
And that's a segment of the trailer of 2021's film Mass, written and directed by Frank Kranz, starring Reed Birney and Dare, Jason Isaacs and Martha Plimpton. A very slimline production, a very slimline cast, but my life, what a piece of work. So the story of Mass starts with Frank Kranz. Now, here is a man who'd built up a solid acting career by the time he was heading to the later part of his 30s. In particular, he'd earned plaudits for his key role in Joss Whedon's TV series Dollhouse. He'd picked up film credits in movies such as, again, Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing, but also Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Roderick Rules. And then there was a 2017 screen adaptation of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream that he also produced. But still, if you go over his filmography during his 20s and early 30s, there wasn't really much sign of an overt intention to move into writing and directing a feature film. But that is what he intended to do, certainly on the writing side. And he talked extensively about this in an interview that I found over at SAG Indy. And he said that he was building his acting career up, but in tandem with that, he was writing scripts, but he was quite shy about showing them to other people. In fact, when he showed his reps one of his scripts, when he finally plucked up the courage to do so, an alien invasion idea, well, his reps weren't really that interested. Kranz would go on to say a bit further down the line that it would be like a $100 million blockbuster movie, and it just, I mean, it wasn't even really being put out to market. So what this led to was Frank Kranz realizing that if he was going to get one of his scripts made, he was going to have to do it the independent way. He was going to have to write something far more frugal, and then he was more than likely going to have to find the money himself and force his way into screenwriting and screen directing. And it was towards the end of the 2010s that he found his idea. And as he explained, he said, "I got the idea for this doing research about mass shootings in America, where I learned about particular meetings." Now, these are meetings that take place between families of the victims of mass shootings and families of the shooter as well. And he said, "As soon as I read about these meetings, it reminded me of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which was a huge inspiration on the film that he was about to write. He described it as both a source of inspiration, but also fear, because he admitted, I did not know if I could partake in the idea of restorative justice." He said, "When I first learned about the TRC in South Africa, I thought I would need retribution. I would need punishment." And there were these conflicting thoughts really in his head that was starting to form into just some kind of story, because it was the discovery of the existence of these meetings that was his key turning point, and he began getting a rough draft of a story idea down on paper. It took a lot of research, umpteen articles, umpteen books. He watched true life documentaries as well, and in the end it was around 2 years on and off of research before he got to the point where he was, I say confidently, but in a position to write something down of note. And then it took around 3 months to get a first draft of the film that would become Mass together. It was by the end of April 2018 he was finally in a position where he just thought, I could send this out. And he, as he described, he said, "I'm crying in front of my laptop for a year and a half to get to that point, just by nature of the research that he was putting into his head and then just trying to do all of this some kind of justice." Now, this time he wasn't going to be held back by reluctant agents, and he decided to send the script out himself to a range of people, courting their opinions. There's something about the old Stephen King adage in his book on writing, where he describes how he writes with the door closed and edits with the door open. But what Frank Kranz realised here was he'd written something that felt prescient and also felt urgent. It felt timely. It felt like the kind of thing he wanted to make as soon as possible. So he sent it out to people he trusted, to a reasonable range as well, got their feedback, continued to shape the script, and eventually he was able to pull the project together. It took about another year from the point of sending the draft out, just over a year, before we got to a point where there was an announcement of the cast, that he'd found funding through a production company called 7 Eccles Street. This is a very, very slimline production, as I mentioned before. The budget for it, not even said to cross $300,000, which in the scheme of American film, incredibly, incredibly cheap. But then the subject matter wasn't screaming big blockbuster success. Also, Kranz had written a film that basically takes place in a room. Virtually all of the film is four participants sat in a room having a conversation with each other. I mean, that's hard to turn into a trailer, yet alone a film, but that was the challenge he'd set himself. It was going to require a cast and a half to pull this off, and it was in November 2019 that the Hollywood Trades reported A, the existence of the picture, and B, the people who had signed up to star in it. And as I mentioned before, that cast: Jason Isaacs, Martha Plimpton, Reed Burney, someone who'd become friends with Frank Kranz during their time doing theatre in New York, and then also Anne Dowd, all signing up to the film. It was Reed Burney who was first through the door. He took hold of a copy of the script in the autumn of 2018, and he knew that this wasn't going to be a film to make anyone rich, not least him, but it was a turning point once the cast starting to come together, not least the decision to bring in casting directors to help him. Henry Russell Bergstein and Alison Estrin are credited in interviews that Kranz did promoting the picture. They got the script out there, but also in terms of sending an offer out to actors for an independent film, he got the other ingredients in place. First of all, he didn't need much of the actor's time. This was going to be done start to finish in under a month, including rehearsal time. Then also he found a location in Idaho and was able to lock it down. So he was able to go out to actors with a script, B, a location, and C, the exact times they would be needed for the filming. And so there was interest. Both Jason Isaacs and Martha Plimpton would ask to meet Frank Kranz, and they would sign up soon after that. But Isaacs would tell Screen in an interview, as the film was just heading to release, he said, I thought when I heard about it, well, that's a clucking terrible idea. And he said, it doesn't sound to me like it can make a movie. It's four people in a room talking, and the guy making it is a young actor. He's never made anything before. But then he read the script. And in Jason Isaacs' words, he said, I suddenly heard the birds tweeting and I saw the sun and I felt alive. And I thought, whoa, I still don't know if it's a film, and I don't know if I can do what's required as an actor. I just don't know if I can strip everything away and be real enough, honest enough to have this happen to me. But he knew he was definitely interested, and he asked to meet Frank Kranz, and the pair of them met in Los Angeles, where Isaacs was shooting at the time. They met in a Starbucks, had a conversation, and he was on board. Likewise, Frank Kranz had a meeting with Martha Plimpton. She signed on the dotted line as well. And Dad came in to complete the quartet. Kranz also, going into the shoot of the movie, knew how he was going to have to do this. He was going to require long takes, and so the actors he'd gone to had some grounding somewhere along the line in theatre that they would be able to be on for a prolonged period of time while the camera was rolling. This couldn't be captured in 30-second segments. This was going to require intense concentration, a real commitment to performance. The fact that he didn't have posh amenities, he didn't have much budget, he had to go out with something that appealed to the actors, and he duly did. And so he assembled them. And in November 2019, at the point the casting announcement hit the Hollywood trade presses, well, that's when filming was underway as well. When I talk about stories of independent films, one of the questions that generally comes up with filmmakers that I speak to is were you able to get rehearsal time? Because rehearsal time on blockbusters is tricky enough, but independents, where every day is stretching the budget to the nth degree, is tricky. Now, Martha Plimpton, for one, was right up front from the start about wanting to rehearse this first. That she recognised the intensity of the material they were putting on screen, and built into the schedule was 2.5 days of rehearsal. Now, Frank Kranz would say he felt that that was vital. What they didn't do in that rehearsal was play the whole thing through. I mean, they talked about it, if anything. They pushed and pulled the screenplay. They adjusted it. They worked out how the characters would work. But what they weren't doing was running the thing long. This wasn't a dress rehearsal or anything like that. They were interrogating the script that Kranz had put together. He was tuning it. And, I mean, Jason Isaacs, again, a separate interview with Under the Radar, he would admit that when filming then began, he was a little bit, well, there was something. Let me put it in his words. He said, "I actually wasn't impressed when we first shot because I had no idea if this was going to make a film or not." What Frank Kranz did was manage to keep himself and the cameras, which turned out to be doing extraordinary things, calibrated lens shifts and all the stuff we weren't aware of, he managed to keep them out of our minds. So for the purposes of the actors, they were in a room and able just to concentrate fairly heavily on the work. And Frank Kranz, going back to that SAG Indie interview, he just said it was good to begin in a collaborative mindset because ultimately when we got into the rehearsal with the four actors, Martha, Jason, Anne and Reed, I was still in that mode of collaboration. And he was putting to his actors, "You tell me what this is. You tell me what you think. You tell me what's wrong or what you want to see." And he described how that was essential to our rehearsal process, that they had all the beats they needed to get to the emotional place they needed to go, that there was no confusion, there was no apprehension, there wasn't dislike of any line they had. As Frank Kranz said, "I needed them so locked to carry them on their way, so to speak." And so the guts of that shoot was primarily one room, but Kranz ran two cameras in the room. So it meant that, first of all, that there were two cameras trained on four actors at all times, appreciating there were close-ups and such like. But one of the cameras was in there deliberately to capture reactions. And as he argued, we would shoot in such a quick and efficient way that you just wanted to trust that all four actors were completely present and reacting in real time. And he knew that part and parcel of getting the drama of this meeting out was just capturing the small nuanced reactions from the actors to what was being said and the lines that were being delivered. They had just 14 days of shooting, so they needed to get through it relatively quickly. And in fact, at first, they were getting through, 10, 12 pages of material a day, a real break. It paced that for a feature film, but then as things got more and more intense, the pace of production had to slow down to reflect that. The sequence, particularly in the room with four actors talking, was shot over a period of 8 very, very intense days. But then Isaacs himself would say he found that process really, really immersive. The idea of there being long takes, running for up to 20 minutes at a time. And he went back to the point, said, "I don't remember there ever being cameras." He said, "We had this very intense, emotional, intimate, transformational experience, the four of us, for 2 weeks. And that was the guts of the shoot. Because they were in Idaho as well, and they're in a very rural area, the cast would spend their evenings together. It'd be very tight knit. Isaacs would adopt an American accent for his character. He would only drop his American accent after filming had finished. So they went out for a meal on the last night once, the rapper being called. And it's only then that out came the more native UK accent. Filming was done en masse by the end of November, and in December 2019, Frank Kranz sent it over to his editor, Yanghua Hu. The music as well, I should credit to Darren Moores for the movie as well, and the cinematography to Ryan Jackson Healy. And, I mean, this was the part that was really, really, really new to him. Because, again, going to what Frank Kranz was talking about with SAG Indie, he said he had a total panic attack of going into the editing process. He hadn't done it. Ordinarily, as an actor, he would deliver his work. He would the rap would be called. They'd go off to a rap party or whatever. They'd say their farewells. Someone else would have to do this bit. But this very, very draining and emotional material that had been part of his life for a long time by this point, well, his job was still some way from being completed, because now he had to edit into place. There were two cameras in the midst of it as well, so they had to intertwine the reaction shots too. And Kranz would be fairly open about the fact that they were having to push and pull from various bits of the 2-week shoot to make the conversations really just work to really glue them together in the edit. He described how our camera movement tried to mirror or parallel the emotional arc of the characters. But he just said, when you're editing it, you're still in that room, which is essentially very neutral, nearly white walls. And they had to be for the kind of meeting that was taking place. He says there's not a lot of change. So you kind of lose your mind a little bit. But then he argued we were very creative that way as well. He said a lot of times we were pulling reactions and even sound from different parts of the conversation to construct the scene you see in the movie. He did find it incredibly tough, and at times he feared he wouldn't actually be able to find the film in the midst of what he'd shot and put together. But then he got to a point where, after a couple of months, there was a rough cut ready in February 2020, and that was screened. And I mean, he was incredibly nervous about its screening, but the response to it was really strong. Now, I first became aware of the film Mass listening to Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo's radio show, where Jason Isaacs, a regular feature of that show, had been in touch with Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo and telling them about this really special film that he'd done. Now, Jason Isaacs makes lots of films. He goes into them with his eyes open. I mean, Skyfire is an absolute hoot, but I think he knew going into that that wasn't going to win a Best Picture Oscar or anything like that. But by the sounds of it, I can't speak for him, but by the sounds of it, I picked this up from as a listener of those shows. He was incredibly proud and making people aware of this micro budget film that he would go on to describe in interviews around the film's release as one of the best things he had ever done. For Frank Kranz, I mean, he talked as it headed towards release about how Mass had been, quote, a full-time job. He said, I wrote and directed, but I also produced. And here's the thing about an independent filmmaker. It wasn't just enough to make the film. The hard bit then, once you've done all the other hard bits, is getting it out into the world. He said, I was also a financier. He said, I'm so busy with Mass, he said, just, and this was after it had been released, trying to get it out there, still dealing with distribution and foreign territories, and just trying to find anyone interested in buying this very, very tough sell movie. The film would debut at the Sundance Film Festival in January 2021, and the response still many months ahead of when most of us had the opportunity to see it for the first time. The response to it was incredibly strong. It's interesting that quite a lot of the reviews talk about how the audience sort of has to meet the film a bit halfway, that this is you have to be invested in it. You can't watch this on an iPad and something else is going on in the room. It demands your attention. It deserves your attention as well. The acting was hugely, hugely, hugely praised as well. And the film the bare minimum of guts you need to make a film, that four people in a room, the fact that they managed to get 110 minutes out of it, and for it to work so well, was really, really quite extraordinary. And so, I mean, the early word on it was quite something. Jason Isaacs talks about this as well, about how he didn't know how it was going to go down. But as he told Under the Radar, the feedback started to trickle in from people in the industry, and reviews from Sundance started coming in, and it became apparent that Fran did something miraculous. Now, Mass, I think, is an extraordinary film. An extraordinary film. It would get its first proper audience release in the US, picked up by Bleecker Street in October of 2021. I mean, it's barely worth looking at the box office numbers for it. I would ask you to bear in mind, this is a film that cost $300,000. Bleecker Street put it onto four screens the weekend of the 8th to the 10th of October 2021, where it finished in 28th place on its opening weekend with a gross of $13,485. Now, its screen average was not great either, really, for a limited platform release, $3,300. The number one film that weekend was No Time to Die, which opened with $55 million and a $12,000 screen average. Films also in the top 10, I mean, they just weren't competing with it. Venom, Let There Be Carnage, The Addams Family 2, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, Many Saints of Newark. There were a few smaller platform releases as well, but even, I mean, The Rescue was in there with a screen average of 7,200. No one is going to sit here, not least me, and say that Mass was a box office hit. It wasn't an art house hit. It didn't really break out at all. By the time it had finished its US box office run, $145,000. Outside of the US, $111,000. In the UK, it was picked up by Sky Cinema, that debuted it on the Sky Cinema service. And so there were not queues around the block for the film, although I would suggest there arguably should have been. But this was a film where it needed film festivals and it needed awards, really, to give it a lift and to put it on people's radars. But here's the other kicker of a low budget independent film: just getting the thing seen by people who vote in awards, that was a challenge in itself. The movie, scandalously, as far as I'm concerned, didn't interest the Academy Awards at all. Now, in fairness to the BAFTAs, they put Anne Dowd forward for Best Supporting Actress of the movie, but there are four outstanding performances in the midst of this. It picked up a couple of prizes: the Independent Spirit Award, the Hollywood Critics Association gave it, so one or two film societies gave it gongs as well. But it didn't get the major awards push and the major awards recognition it arguably deserved and perhaps needed to be able to break it through to a bigger audience. That said, Mass is still out there in the world and is still an extraordinary piece of work. And the one thing that can continue to get it to a broader audience is word of mouth, and for people who perhaps sit in a room by themselves recording a podcast to dedicate half of an episode to it. It is my small, and it is a tiny contribution, but it is my small contribution just to encourage more people to seek out this film that on the surface might sound like the last thing you want to watch, but by God, an extraordinary piece of work. And for Fran Kranz, I mean, I have absolutely nothing but applause. I try not to really do reviews of films as I talk about them on this podcast, but for a directorial debut, and he's not directed a film since, hopefully he's working on one, this is quite, quite wonderful. And that brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If I've not bored you completely, you can find more from me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Simon Brew. You can find Film Stories on both of those platforms at Film Stories. You can find it on Facebook at Film Stories Online. You can find Film Stories on YouTube at youtube.com/filmstories. I'm just starting to add video Film Stories that show my face and wonky eye on there. Please be gentle in the comments, but really trying to ramp some of that stuff up. I've got news on a couple of events coming up. We've not booked any events for a while, but there is progress there. Hopefully I'll have more on that in the next week or so. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, you can buy our print magazines and our UK exclusive Blu-rays of Bull Durham and No Way Out. We put our own extra features on there as well. And then if you go to filmstories.co.uk, that is a website, a clickbait free movie, games, TV website, clickbait free. Those articles, you know, all those articles that we all dislike reading where you have to get through 500 words to get to the point. None of that. Makes it really hard to get it recognised, but hopefully it's starting to cut through a bit more. Filmstories.co.uk. We're doing some long form stuff there and I hope you really like it. And the Patreon again. Is patreon.com/Simon Brew. But I have outstayed my welcome once more, so I'm going to sign off and wish you all the very best and thank you for listening. I'm going off to watch another load of films. I'm then going to put together another podcast. I'll be back soon with some more film stories. You all take care. Thank you and bye-bye.